Well, I'd like to go back to the 1956 Democratic Convention out in San Francisco. I had discovered several weeks before the convention, quite by accident, that the Democratic National Committee had prepared a film which they intended to show at the National Convention. I came out of a meeting with Frank Stanton one day and told him I'd discovered this and said that I did not intend to use it. And the reason, he asked why, and I said the reason is very simple, that we're there to cover a news event. We're not there to cover a pageant. We're there for explaining what's going on, and that's our fundamental purpose. If we let ourselves be talked into showing a film, then we become a publicity agency for the Democratic National Committee. I got no further response from it, and but I've made my point. A few days before the National Convention, a film was delivered to us by an agent of Teleprompter Corporation. So it is a Democratic National Committee film. I had our film man take a look at it, and we wrecked the thing up, all right. No, we didn't wreck it up, excuse me. We made the decision that if we wanted to go to the film, what we would do is take it off the screen. In other words, we'd focus the camera on the screen just as a person in the house would see it. So that was the decision, and it was a matter of deep principle, I thought, that we not get into a position of becoming an outlet for national party publicity. The film started. I began to get telephone calls from the stage, from our man on the stage, that Paul Butler, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, was livid with fury because we were not carrying it. I was informed there was going to be a blast when it was all over. He was really going to blast us. And he did. When the film was over, incidentally, we'd covered a little bit of it. We'd been around picking up threads here and there of what was going on and the importance of certain moves that were taking place. We came back and took some in the hall. The quality wasn't very good, but we could show a part of it. And incidentally, one other little thing, the narrator for the film was a young senator from Massachusetts named John F. Kennedy. And I think probably his father had something to do with the whole story. But Butler let go with a blast. He made a speech in which he cordially, enthusiastically embraced both ABC and NBC for their fine patriotic spirit in showing the film, and didn't say a word about us, but then the boom started from the whole hall. It rose up en masse. Frank Stanton, who was sitting in a box, apparently decided he better get out of there fast, with fists being shaken at him and so forth. He came around to the other side of the building where we had our studio set up. And then, of course, we had to build backfires on this one. And he came completely to our defense in that situation. And we put out the statement explaining that we were there to cover a news event. And we didn't regard that as part of a news event. We were exercising our own judgment. I also found out, however, that Paul Butler had asked him whether they ought to produce the film. And he'd said yes, but only he'd go ahead and produce it. So he was in kind of an ambivalent position at that point. But I think that's a case of the Democratic National Committee manipulating a news event to try to entrap the television networks into carrying it, and we resisted. However, unfortunately, at the 1960 convention, there had been so much animus created by our failure in 1956 that they prepared films again, and this time we played dead and rolled over and ran the film so that they won it. But of course, the whole business is one of the most dangerous aspects of the television coverage. It's what is real and what is fake, what is created. The old newsreels have, in many cases, recreated circumstances. They had their big, heavy, cumbersome 35-millimeter equipment, some of a double system, and it was not portable to the point where you could run and set up and get something, so they'd go in and recreate an event. Also, the maximum running time for a reel of 35 millimeter was about 10 minutes, and you couldn't expect the event to break at the end of every 10 minutes and resume again. So even much of the See It Now stuff, for example, in a sense, was recreated for television. And when you recreate something, then is it legitimate, or are you simply creating a trend toward permitting the creation of events? Are you really photographing live actuality, or are you photographing something which is
should be stamped made for television. The first time I ran into a situation where we were guilty occurred during the Little Rock Central High School riots in 1957. We had a mobile unit parked in front of Central High School and in a position to watch the demonstrations, and in some cases the demonstrations turned up to with some clubbing and fist slinging and the like. I picked up the New York Times one morning after we'd had some rather dramatic pictures the night before and read a piece by Homer Biggert to the effect that our camera crew had not been in position to catch one of the demonstration groups coming up the street to Central High School, and had stopped them and asked them to go back down the street a block and come back a second time so we could get them on television. Well, I defended that for a while and then began to ask some questions and found out that, yes, our camera crew had done it. Well, this led us to some serious thinking about how far we dared go in recreating that kind of an event, because if we were to do it, we might be responsible for establishing all kinds of situations in which peaceful demonstrations turn into riots, because again, the rioters are likely the one to perform for cameras. We had another example a couple years later during the sit-down runs in the South, all the sit-down strikes and the particularly lunch counter and restaurant sit-downs. We had a crew in Nashville, and I got a call from the president and general manager of our affiliated television station there, who asked me why our crew on the scene had not been had not come to see him before they started filming some sequences. And we found out later that they had gone in, had met with a group planning a set-down, and I guess had worked with the crew in determining exactly what time the set-down was to take place and in what restaurant it was to take place, so they could be at the Rideau March and in the restaurant in advance with their cameras. All right, we were guilty then of creating a set-down for television purposes. And this, I'm afraid, could have resulted in some rather serious repercussions in Nashville at the time. The governor obviously was upset. He was upset because, of course, this could have led to a riot. And you don't know. Now, from the other point of view, of course, people are smart enough to know that when that camera is there, they can perform in front of a camera. Sometimes it's rather simple, like a crowd at a football game, seeing the camera focused on them, they start behaving like adolescents, or even worse, infantile behavior. But on the other hand, some of the demonstrators during that period of the rioting in the late 60s, early 70s, felt that they could get their cases across by getting a television camera and being quite outrageous in front of that television camera to make the point. It seems to me that it's terribly important for television executives to be cautious, to be prepared for a variety of situations, take a position which is not going to stimulate, or if they can possibly avoid it, stimulate any spontaneous combustion on the part of the public. On the other hand, they can't very well avoid going into combustible situations because it's part of news coverage. So it takes a rational group of people with level heads in order to do a television job, much more so than newspapers. The trouble with television is it's so obtrusive. The cameras are getting smaller, much smaller than they used to be, but there are mobile units and tape recorders and so forth, and all of it has a tendency to compel too much attention on the part of the public.
In dealing with these problems at CBS News, I'm sure policies evolved. Did you write these policies? Did you do it in concert with management or other executives in the news department? How did you go about that?
Well, there are certain basic policies which come more or less directly out of the Federal Communications Act of 1934. For example, the Fairness Clause is there. Now, there are certain interpretations of it. Some of the interpretations, for example, came from statements made by senior management. The chairman, for example, Mr. Paley, made a speech to an NAB convention in 1954 when he received the Distinguished Service Award, in which he identified objectivity as being the, quote, will and intent of the broadcaster to be objective, end quote. Well, that we adopted as policy. Then we'd modify certain policies to apply to certain situations as we went along. Sometimes I'd write a policy memorandum and send it on up to Haley and Stanton, for example, to see whether they approved of it. Sometimes, if I didn't think that was necessary, I'd just issue the policy memorandum without getting any further approval. Sometimes we formulated policy through a group known as the editorial board, which normally met on a once-a-week basis, and we'd attack some difficult situations and decide how to approach it, and the approach should be detailed in the minutes. We would then reach into the minutes and build a policy statement around the minutes. So there are various ways that policy evolved.
And what sort of specific problems were you dealing with in those policies?
Well, we've been talking about some of them, how to handle situations like sit-downs and...
Live on-the-spot news events.
Yeah, live on-the-spot news events. But another one, question, what do you do about instant news analysis after the president finishes a speech? At one time, we decided, and I sent down a memorandum, saying that when the president finished an official White House speech that we carried, we'd put up the flag, play the Star Spangled Banner, and that would be the end of it, and we wouldn't go into any analysis. Well, then that was changed a number of times. We did policy on that. There was policy, well, it's not important policy, but on introduction of personnel. For example, we started doing this, person didn't introduce himself fore and aft, but only at the end when they say, this is George Herman in the at Health, Education, and Welfare. That sort of thing we did. I've forgotten what the... Well, the policies on answers, for example, who would have the right to answer for fairness purposes, which is an interpretation of the fairness doctrine. And we had to frame various policies with respect to that kind of thing.
Was it your policy to refuse to air any documentaries from outside sources, that all documentaries had to be produced within CBS News?
That was a general policy, but that was not the policy statement. The policy statement was that we would not air anything concerning controversial issues over which we did not have complete control because of the danger in so doing of putting our affiliated stations in the position where they were espousing causes over which they had no advanced knowledge of any type. Give you one specific example. When Dave Wolpert came in with his show, The Race for Space, on the beginnings of the U.S. space program. The Wolpert Show used General Medaris, who was the head of space operations for the U.S. Army, as the protagonist in that one-hour program. We were very well aware, for example, it was a good show, by the way, and did very well when it was syndicated throughout the country. I looked at it and considered it seriously. It was a good program, but we knew that at that time, the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and NACA, the National, what is it? Now it's NASA at least, but before it became NASA, that they were all contesting to see who'd get control of space. And if we went with Medaris, the Army general, and made him the protagonist, we would be placing ourselves on the side of the Army with respect to this battle going on inside the government at that time. So we felt that we could not accept that show. Now, on the other hand, there were others that we did accept. For example, the old Armstrong Circle Theater frequently would do what you might call dramatic documentaries.
Dramatized documentaries.
Yeah, dramatized documentaries.
But those were not under the auspices of CBS News.
No, but I had to read every one of them before it went on the air. So that I was in a position then to call Bob Foreman down at BBD and all and say, Bob, will you change this or that because there are policy problems involved.
BBDO was the agency for Armstrong.
They were the agency for Armstrong. And I also, for example, read some Playhouse 90 for the same reason. They were done even within the shop, but I read them in advance to analyze them against CBS News policy.
Judgment at Nuremberg, for example?
Yeah, and with the gas chamber involved in it.
Yes, perhaps you should give the background on that.
Well, the background on that is that the American Gas Association was one of the sponsors, and the American Gas Association insisted that gas chamber could not be mentioned in that show. So when there was a sentencing to the gas chamber, the word gas was eliminated, and there was a beep at that point, which is probably the most ridiculous case.
sponsor meddling.
Sponsor meddling in the whole history of the business, I guess. But no, that's, we accepted some. Then there were, and some of them, for example, a freelance producer would come in with an idea. And I've forgotten specifically what falls in this category, but he would produce it under our aegis. Now, the criticism from the outside was that all we were doing was reserving the positions for our own staff members. And to some extent, that's true, insofar as we had put together a staff that had a lot of good people in it, and there weren't very many on the outside who were as competent as the people who were on the inside. And furthermore, the people on the inside had some respect for policy questions, for fairness doctrines and that sort of thing. So it was a lot easier on the inside, and particularly if you got into anything highly controversial.
Perhaps now would be a good time to ask you about your views on the Fairness Doctrine. The Communications Act of 1934 may be rewritten and new legislation may supersede it. Knowing you, I would assume you would like to see the Fairness Doctrine written out of any new legislation.
Yeah, I don't. I think that the Fairness Doctrine is not a weapon which is used every day and which government is using with a heavy hand. But I think the trouble with the Fairness Doctrine is that it gives many station operators an excuse to avoid projecting themselves into any kind of a controversial issue. If they know, for example, that taking a stand on a controversial issue is going to force them to give equal time to all sides, it simply gets them into all kinds of trouble. And it's a lot easier to be totally bland and just refrain from getting involved into anything that's controversial. I think that's the most dangerous aspect of the Fairness Doctrine. I think we'd have a much more vital, a much more vibrant form of broadcast journalism if the Fairness Doctrine were not there. Now, we didn't have a Fairness Doctrine actually written as such until 1959. There was no Fairness Doctrine at all until 1949, and we didn't get into any serious trouble. We're the only country in the world that has a Fairness Doctrine, so that it's spelled out as such. So I just think that there's no real reason to have one. We'd be better off without it. Furthermore, we have such a multiplicity of media that it's unlikely that any one medium is going to so dominate the whole news spectrum that it can succeed in achieving its way in any kind of a controversial issue. For example, we're talking now in San Diego, and there are at least 10 or 12 television stations coming in here by cable or otherwise. There are 18 to 20 radio stations right in the San Diego metropolitan area. In addition to Los Angeles and Mexican stations coming in, we have two local metropolitan daily newspapers, a group of suburban daily newspapers. The Los Angeles Times comes in here with a local edition. Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, the Wall Street Journal. We've got so much that no one station is going to play a Pied Piper role to the extent where it can seriously damage us. I think we could take it out. I think deregulation seems to be a logical next step in radio broadcasting, and it makes a lot of sense. Let the marketplace govern. In television, maybe we need some regulation for a while, but there it seems to me we could ease off on the regulation.
If you're in favor of the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine, are you also in favor of the abolition of the other provisions in Section 315 that provide equal opportunity for political candidates?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You don't believe the exceptions in there provide enough freedom for news operations?
No, I think you ought to extend the exceptions further if you're going to retain the 315. I don't think, for example, it's necessary for a metropolitan station if it provides debate time or time in the air for the two principal candidates for the Senate to go and pick up all of the fringe candidates as well and give them time as is now mandated in Section 315. There are some ridiculous cases in the past that have occurred as a result of 315, and what it actually has done is inhibit coverage of election campaigns by, again, permitting a station operator to be bland and cautious and to stay out of trouble by not giving anybody any time. If you took 315 out of there, I think you'd find a lot of the principal candidates getting time. Now, the disadvantage? What happens with the new third party? Well, it's when the third party begins to achieve enough strength and has strong enough candidates, it's going to be in there getting the time.
How will it achieve that strength, however, if they don't have access to large radio and television audiences?
I don't think the radio and television audience is that important in building a person or a party up to that kind of strength. There's so many other ways of doing it. There's direct mail by computer actually now is costing almost as much as broadcasting, and it's become a great talent and a great art to get these computerized mailing lists and do these computerized mailings. And, you know, in the small community or the smaller communities, well, in the big city, there still is an opportunity in the congressional district to go out and shake a lot of hands and meet a lot of people and get your own organization. No, I think they'll come to the surface.
In conjunction with Section 315, maybe you'd comment on the evolution of broadcast editorializing over the years. Many stations do it regularly, and some stations do it occasionally. There do seem to be hundreds, perhaps even thousands of stations in this country that don't editorialize at all.
Well, this is that tendency on the part of many station operators to stay out of trouble, just not get themselves into controversial positions at all. That's why there's been a good deal of pressure on station operators in the past to stand up in the community, take positions in the community, establish some record for themselves, to show some courage, and many of them are doing it. Now, for a long time, they were not. That famous Mayflower decision in the 1940s prevented it, but gradual relaxation and the writing or the promulgation of a fairness doctrine made it possible for editorializing to start in the 1950s. We did some experimentation at CBS to try to determine. We hired an editorialist for a UHF station we had in Hartford, Connecticut, and a very bright person who was a good local reporter and a thinker and so forth and knew how to research a topic. We turned him loose on a variety of ways of doing editorials. I think the senior management of CBS had a feeling that maybe the only way you could do it is put it on something like a teleprompter so it becomes written and have an off-camera voice read it so there's no identification with an individual. Well, that was pretty dull. Then we went from there to the idea that since this is not the news broadcaster's idea, but it's a station idea, that we can achieve the same effect by having the station manager read the editorial. Now, some station managers are not too effective at it, and they appoint an editorial director who does it. But I think those hurdles have now been overcome, and I think it's pretty well established that the editorial is not the personal opinion of the chief anchorman, but it rather is the well-thought-out position of the station itself and the station management on a given issue. And I think editorializing has been developing rapidly in the last 10 to 15 years, even though there are many stations that ought to be doing more of it. But it's a way a station exercises leadership in the community.
In connection with Section 315, maybe you'd like to give us your recollections on the Kennedy-Nixon debates in 1960.
Well, yeah, I can do that. The debate idea had been talked about over a long period of time. I think the first person actually to start the movement for debates was Senator Blair Moody from Michigan as early as 1952. Moody had been the correspondent for the Detroit News and then was appointed to the Senate and elected for a term. And he saw the possibility of debates. Well, this was picked up particularly by Frank Stanton at CBS, who made many speeches about debating. Bobby Sarnoff at NBC also became a strong supporter. But the trouble is that you just couldn't do it as long as Section 315 was on the books without some kind of amendment. There were usually from 16 to 19 candidates for the presidency of the United States, including the Prohibition Party, the Poor Man's Party, the Socialist Workers' Party, the Socialist Labor Party, and, you know, a host of others, Vegetarian Party, including Henry Krajewski, the Poor Man's Party candidate, who lived in Secaucus, New Jersey, and ran a beer hall. But we had been trapped in 1956 by Section 315. Just after the Israeli-Egyptian war broke out, around the 1st of November, and the situation around the world was very, very precarious, the president asked for time to make a 15-minute speech to the nation about the dangers involved in that Middle Eastern war. We gave him this time because we thought this is an absolutely essential matter of national policy, even though he is a candidate. Well, the Democrats immediately asked for time to answer. We said, well, what's this presidential message? And obviously that it doesn't demand a response under Section 315. They got a decision that it did, so time had to be given to Stevenson, and of course all the other candidates came on down the line to demand their time. Eisenhower, in the meantime, or not Eisenhower, but the Republicans, since time had been given to Stevenson, asked for time to answer Stevenson, since the president originally had been speaking as president, not as candidate. And this thing turned into an unholy mess, which the FCC settled after the election was over.
CBS did not appeal that?
Yeah, appealed it, but got nowhere in the appeal.
I see.
And that they appealed, and the FCC said, we can't give you an answer right now, except there in Section 315. We'll give you an answer later. Well, the only thing we could do is give the time.
Was CBS active in encouraging the 1960 debates and getting
the
amendment through the Congress?
Yeah, on the debates, Frank Stanton was very active, working with the members of the Congress in getting the repeal. It wasn't repealed, actually, as I recall, until late spring or early summer of 1960. I guess it was probably July before the thing was actually repealed. Then, of course, the next question is, we've got repeal. Now we can go with the debates. It was repealed only for one election period and only for candidates for president and vice president. So we were in the position then where, how do you get the two combatants in the ring? You know, who's going to be the matchmaker in this case? And we were skeptical right up until the last minute. You know, we thought that either candidate would find some objections, but Nixon accepted in theory. While the Republican convention was on, Kennedy accepted shortly thereafter. So we had the acceptances, but now we've got to write the rules and regulations. So as soon as we got back to New York after the Democratic convention, the Republican convention in Chicago, we got a meeting of the networks and the candidates' representatives and started talking about ground rules. Now they said, you've been talking grandiosely about 8 hours of time for the candidates. One party said, we'll take four, you give the other party four. Well, we had to say, now, look, that's not what we said at all. What we said is there are going to be debates. That means you've got to both be there, both be present for the debates. So this went round and round for a while. Then we met again, finally, at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington. And we're still in this standoff position, the impasse, until Fred Scribner for the Republicans and Leonard Rensch for the Democrats said, why don't you give us a few minutes alone here to hammer this thing out when you step outside. So John Daly for ABC, Bill McAndrew for NBC, and I went out in the corridor for 20 minutes to a half an hour. And when we came back, they spelled out a procedure that they thought would work, which is essentially the way the debates finally went on the air. We would have preferred pure debate, but since it was not going to be, and since we wanted more than anything to get them in the ring, we yielded on that point. I guess the only one we argued with them on was the fact that we would not select newspaper representatives to serve on the panels. They'd have to find some other way of doing that. So with that, we went ahead on the debate.
Since we've been discussing presidential candidates, perhaps you'd give us your recollections over the years on the relationship between CBS News and the White House, beginning perhaps with Eisenhower?
Well, you can even go back, I guess, to Harry Truman, for that matter.
Okay.
There's been an evolution, I guess, which probably parallels the evolution of an importance of the television business. We're talking largely television rather than radio, I guess. And, of course, television was so new during the Truman period that, you know, the White House, whereas it was conscious of it, and the administration asked for time from time to time for television broadcast purposes. The audience we could reach was so small that it really was not a sufficient consequence to make a major issue out of it. And that didn't happen until in the Eisenhower administration. Now, Jim Haggerty, the press secretary, and incidentally a very, very good one, was conscious of the importance of it, even though he was a newspaper man, and did what he could to permit television into activities and to call attention to activities. But the president himself, for example, had eye problems and didn't like those television lights